This recording is the property of the Winogren Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section's lecture series for October 10th, 2013, Kuru Sorcery Revisited.
Hey, it looks like we're all sitting comfortably. I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of Winogren. I'd like to welcome you here for the Kuru event. And with that said, I will turn you over to Brian, who will give the introduction.
Hi. Thanks for coming, everyone. Great turnout. Looking forward to this talk tonight. Just to let you know, I'm Brian Boyd from Columbia University, Anthropology, Archaeology. And I'm one of the new co-chairs of the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Division, along with Janice Sodikoff from Rutgers. I'd like to thank the Winogren, as usual, for providing this wonderful space, and more importantly, their wonderful wine. So thank you, Leslie, thank you, Laurie, and everyone who has done this. I want to tell you what the next talk is, so it's in your diary. You'll get emails if you're on the email list. If you're not, let me know afterwards. The next talk is Barbara Rose Johnson from the Center for Political Ecology on October the 21st, October 21, which is a Monday, and that's our usual meeting times, it's a Monday. And she's going to be talking about nuclear disaster, environmental health, and human rights in the Marshall Islands. So that's 6 p.m. here, and for dinner and lecture, 7 o'clock, okay? Okay, so I'd like to thank Paige West and Raina Rapp and Murphy Halliburton for being here and being our discussants and respondents and so on, Shirley Lindenbaum's talk on Kuru sorcery on the event of the reissue of her classic book that I'm sure we've all read. So I'm just going to launch straight into that. I think Murphy is going to take over the duties here. Enjoy the event and say hello to everyone. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for coming to this event, which is about this book. Here it is, the new updated edition of Shirley Lindenbaum's Kuru Sorcery: Disease and Danger in the New Guinea Highlands, which was released this summer from Paradigm Publishers. I'm going to be very brief, just saying, you know, here they are, your speakers, because I don't want to take time away from them. But this is, you know, this is an important moment. I think long-term research is key in anthropology. Shirley has been following these issues among the foray for, I guess it's about 40 years. Actually, I just was reading the new preface, and it seems you started in the late 1960s, and so I think it's about, you know, 40 years of keeping up with this topic. So that's really a remarkable achievement, I think. So thank you, Shirley, and tonight we're lucky enough to have two respondents to the new edition of Shirley's book, Raina Rapp from NYU and Paige West from Columbia, and I'm going to go ahead and turn the floor over to them. We thought we'd have Raina go first. I'm just suddenly announcing that, and I hope you got a forewarning.
I beat you to it, Murphy, okay. Because I asked and got told 30 seconds ago.
Okay,
is this on? Can you hear me? Great. Okay, well, thanks, first of all, to Jane Schneider for imagining this event and to Murphy for organizing it, and above all, to Winogren, our friends here, as usual, for hosting us. And this is a wonderful celebratory event honoring the publication of the second edition of Kuru Sorcery, Disease and Danger in the New Guinea's Highlands, and thank you for including me among the speakers. I should say at the outset that I know almost nothing about New Guinea except what I absorbed all those decades and decades ago in graduate school and what I learned about the area when Shirley and I were close colleagues for a dozen years at the graduate faculty of the New School. And it was also there that I learned about medical anthropology, and I want to go on record to thank you, Bino. It's your fault that I'm a medical anthropologist. Shirley's research on maternal infant health in Bangladesh was underway in her early years at the graduate faculty, and the first edition of Kuru Sorcery was completed and published while we shared an institutional home. From her vibrant thinking, there flowed a highly creative and very early MA program in medical anthropology whose goal was, as Shirley kept reiterating to everybody who kept raising it, to create first-rate anthropologists who studied in and around the social field of medicine and not to graduate second-rate medical professionals with a smattering of cultural theory. That was an important distinction. The distinction was crucial to what she accomplished there. While we surely recruited our share of health professionals whose curiosity and often whose tuition reimbursement payments led them to our doorstep, Shirley's quiet but rigorous training ensured that they learned substantial ethnographic skill along with epidemiology. We were all hooked, none more so than me. Under Shirley's tutelage, I took a sabbatical semester up at Columbia School of Public Health, now renamed the Mailman School of Public Health, and plunged into the study of the then rapidly rushing stream of new reproductive technologies under your guidance. I will forever be grateful. The books that Shirley was completing during her early New School years was, of course, Kuru Sorcery, and it was then and continues to be now an ethnographer's ethnography. Classic in its deep and holistic ability to integrate historical, ecological, demographic, and social relational analysis with the intimate details of daily life among Foray peoples in the New Guinea Highlands as they confronted the fears, sorrows, and losses of a devastating epidemic. Based on collaborative fieldwork in the early 1960s with Bob Glass, Shirley worked in New Guinea while it was still in Australian Trust territory and returned many times after its independence in 1975 as she watched the epidemic run its harrowing course. The high mortality rate of Kuru was, as Shirley quickly taught us, differentially distributed, and it was women who were disproportionately dying in dense numbers. Despite initial medical perspectives suggesting that this neurodegenerative illness might have a genetic base, Shirley and Bob mapped the genealogies, family and community histories, and mortuary rituals, that's important, whose cannibalism, Shirley announced, explained why women and those who had been young children fed from the cooking pots of their mothers during the epidemic were the most likely to develop the disease. In a region where Swidden horticulture was practiced, animated regional trading relations and flexible kin arrangements led to rapid incorporation and equally rapid schism and expulsion of new relatives and neighbors, and marriage ties solidified production and reproduction, as well as distribution of much-needed comestibles and other goods. Foray's social structure was flexible and unstable, moving across the eastern highlands, poised on a fulcrum between northern and southern groups with whom Foray traded and intermarried, as they also hived off new communities to occupy relatively open lands. In this mix, women played a crucial role. A wife is the hand of man, Shirley said that the Foray said, referring to the considerable labor and wealth in children that they produced. Without control over these wifely productions, no Foray man could hope to ascend in prestige and power. Yet Kuru was killing off the women disproportionately, leading to sorcery accusations that made social life brittle and terrifying for everyone. Women feared for their own lives. Men had to care for dying spouses, becoming single parents with new gender asymmetries in the process, and everyone had a horrific sense that families, lines, villages, and whole regions of the population might well not survive. So this is what Shirley says. Sorcery accusations showed that men living together in one parish harbored mutual suspicions to the often expressed fear of extinction through the loss of women's reproductive powers was now added a fear of internal disruption so great that society itself was in danger. So that's the sense of the epidemic she conveys. The key Shirley provided was a gendered analysis of food Indeed, protein shortage and the cannibalism accompanying funeral rituals through which women excessively ingested the bodies and neurological tissue of those who had died of kuru, feeding them to their children as well. Young boys soon grew into the privileged space of the men's houses, but young girls did not, and they remained co-eaters at their mother's sides, overly exposed. Shirley detailed the importance of sorcery in the foray self-concept, and she documented the extraordinary, quite political rallies that brought a kind of pledge of post-sorcery peace to the region while failing to immediately end the epidemic. She diffused the exoticism of cannibalism in favor of understanding gendered protein and food shortages, not as some driver of abstract evolutionism, Pache Morvan Harris, but as an aspect of local social structure and history. Shirley provides a very sensitive analysis of what would later come to be called globalization, and she sees it as processual. Markets, airplanes, roads, government authorities, research scientists, schools, and clinics all transform local social life and health, including the foray's reflection on their own recent history. Shirley picks up these forces in the first edition, making local social dynamism visible. Systems of trade, land acquisition, mobility, gendered protein scarcity, the incursion of a cash system, the presence of government agents and laws and missions all set the active physical and social map of the foray peoples into increasingly lopsided and unbalanced motion. And in the midst of their epidemic, teams of biomedical researchers set up shop, attempting to figure out what kind of an agent is fueling kuru, its routes of transmission, and how it might eventually be contained. From their research would eventually issue two Nobel Prizes, of course, one for Carlton Gajdacek in 1976 for the theory of slow viruses, and in 1997, Stanley Prusiner would win one for the discovery of prion diseases. Whichever the biomedical theory, both, as many of us have long noted, depend for their understanding of their spread on the practice of cannibalism along lines of gender, kinship, and disprivileged status, in other words, on Shirley's analysis. No cure for kuru or other prion-based neurodegenerative diseases has yet been found, nor is there a Nobel Prize in anthropology, alas, for the scholar who cracked this puzzle. Throughout the book, Shirley suggests subtle comparisons between foray theories of causality drenched with sorcery and those of Western medicine. So let me quote again. As the analysis of foray disease categories makes clear, the need for an active response to illness depends on the victim's status in the community. She will carry through that theme, which is one that we also share with the foray again and again throughout the book. In the first edition, the brittle consequences of sorcery and its accusations are always shot through with power differentiation. Shirley writes, I think this is right. Let's go to this page. Right. A geography of fear tracks unequal relations between neighboring communities from the dominating highland cores to their peripheries. In a mastery illusion projected by an egalitarian ethic, the dispossessed are characterized as a threat, a casuistic line of argument we share with the foray. People in marginal positions are portrayed as a danger to the establishment. It is a paradox the foray repeatedly face, how to dispose of the enemy on whom you also depend. Again, it should ring familiar to people in American society as well. By the time of the second and superb edition, the updated edition that we now have, foray respondents were referring to bovine spongiform encephalopathy and mad cow disease as English kuru. That is, they understood what was going on elsewhere, and designating sick AIDS to differentiate and highlight AIDS, HIV/AIDS, in its infectious rather than in sourcelated form. Local curers carefully guard their forest medicine. One more quote, and then I'm almost done. I couldn't resist the quotes. The topic of the theft of local resources and intellectual property rights has recently acquired a more critical edge. Local practitioners said that bush medicines found only in Papua New Guinea could cure AIDS. This would result in a big income for their countries and perhaps a Nobel Prize. They are not foolish about where prizes come from. After all, they understand all too well that foray blood, urine, feces, autopsy, body parts, and specimens of edible plants and animals will make their way to Euro-American labs, where they will be transformed into Nobel Prizes. Therefore, some local healers, too, anticipate the possibility of a Nobel. Throughout the book, Shirley offers a superbly specific sense of the homegrown statistics and empirical epidemiology wielded by the foray themselves. But also, she stresses the cosmological standoff by which different forms of practice and knowledge-making both reinforce and bypass one another. The scientists discover some genetic variants that may prove protective, for example, and prions replace slow viruses as infectious agents in biomedical understanding. But to the extent that the thin skin of biomedicine remains, as Shirley puts it, long on diagnosis but short on treatment, multiple meanings are assigned to the epidemic, to vulnerability, to modernity, and to the end of cannibalism. This is medical pluralism in practice. We, scientists, religious leaders, government policymakers, anthropologists, we may think we know what really caused Carew's devastation. But it is, as Shirley shows, impossible to disentangle these many interventions which collectively brought the epidemic to a close. The book is a tour de force, a classic in medical anthropology. As Arthur Kleiman reports on the back cover of the new edition, rarely has the long-term follow-up of an ethnographic study produced so comprehensive and compelling a picture of the interplay of history, globalization, colonialism, and science. Foremost most of its accomplishments is that we hear the voices, listen to the understandings, and vividly see the lived experiences of the foray themselves. Kourou's sorcery demonstrates the centrality of medical anthropology in constructing a bridge to other forms of research in public health, molecular and genetic research, and the analysis of deeply unsettling multiple modernities. I want to close by describing another bridge, and Shirley, I hope you're not going to really hate me for this, and also please don't blush while I tell a personal story. This summer, I had the privilege of spending an evening in the beautiful sculpture garden of MoMA, listening to music with Shirley. We went out for the evening, and we allowed us how we both really like to drive, and we got to telling driving stories, and this was my favorite story. Shirley said that when she was in New Guinea, there was a chasm, a washout, and she couldn't get the car, you know, across really rough roads in the highlands, and so Bob Glass got out of the car and put down planks, and lots of foray helpers got them all together, and everybody put the planks down, and Shirley just drove right over, you know, with great panache, right over the bridge. So Shirley forged her bridge to continued work among the foray. Shirley Lindenbaum, intrepid local driver of new interpretations, classic contributor to global understandings not only of the scourge and recovery from this epidemic among a particular people, but also to the importance of medical anthropology in wider interdisciplinary theory and practice. We thank you for this wonderful book.
Sorry, I didn't really map out the whole organization of the event at the beginning. I guess that's a problem with having wine before the event. But we're going to have Paige West speak next, and then Shirley will have comments afterwards, and then there'll be a chance for questions from you all. So let's just go straight ahead to Paige.
So I also want to start by thanking Murphy and Jane and Brian and Wintergren for having us here for this wonderful event tonight. So there's so much that could be said about Kourou sorcery. I could talk about the fact that it is perhaps the best example of why we need anthropological research to understand real-world problems, problems that other disciplines think that they have privileged access to in terms of understanding and explanation. I could talk about the fact that by listening to their foray speaking informants in 1962, really listening to their stories about social relations, human migration, history, locality, and social practices, Shirley Lindenbaum and Robert Glass figured out one of the biggest medical mysteries in history. Along with this, I could talk about the politics of scientific attribution. Because even though Robert Glass figured it out, the Nobel Prize went to someone else. And the recent reemergence of Kourou's studies in the global media has focused on the biomedical and epidemiological researchers associated with the team of scholars that started trying to understand the disease in 1957. I could talk about how Kourou's sorcery shows us that foray peoples have negotiable flexibility in their frameworks for social relations and their alignments and connections. At the time of Shirley's first research and when Coup Research 3 was first published, most anthropologists of New Guinea, who were all busy looking for lineages and clans, had basically overlooked this. The analysis of social connections in the book anticipates later work on networks and the infinite creativity of people informing them. So what I am saying here is that Shirley thought with and theorized networks and assemblages in 1979, based on work she had done in the early 1960s. And this is 8 years before Latour's Science in Action is published. Or I could talk about the extraordinary eastern highlands of Papua New Guinea, the setting for the book. And since I never get to talk about Papua New Guinea, and I have a captive audience, I'm going to talk about Papua New Guinea. So... One bright, clear day 15 years ago, I was struck by the importance of Kuru Sorcery, a book that I read while I was preparing for my qualifying exams the year before. I was struck in a way that felt like getting hit by lightning. I was a graduate student living in the Eastern Highlands for the first time, and I'd been there for about 4 months at that point. And throughout my time there among Gemi-speaking peoples, the Foray's closest neighbors, I'd been working with a young woman who I call Esta in my books and articles. At the time, Esta was, and Barbara, this is, you know who I'm talking about, right? Barbara has met this person. So at the time, she was a recent high school graduate who, while having spent her childhood in her natal Gemi-speaking village, had gone to Goroka, the capital of the Eastern Highlands province, for school. She attended a very rigorous Seventh-day Adventist school from grade 7 onward. She was fluent in English, had traveled with her father, a village health care worker, to many of the cities in Papua New Guinea, and she was an avid reader of novels and magazines, and she loved MTV. She was, in a word, extraordinarily cosmopolitan for that time and that place. The morning I'm remembering now, I was walking from the hamlet Biebatai to the hamlet of Motai with J.C. Salyer, who's in the back of the room and who I'm now married to. And at the time, he was visiting me in the field for the first time. On the way to Motai, we stopped by Esta's grandmother's house. And as we walked up to the house, we saw Esta sitting outside around a cooking fire. And it was an unusual sight because most Gimi cook inside. She was sitting on an old fuel can with her face looking downwards and her hands holding a towel on her forehead. And as we arrived, she looked up and removed the towel. Esta's entire forehead appeared to be covered in blood. In fact, upon closer inspection, a knife cut had been made around the entirety of her now bald head. And as we stood there speechless, I had what was perhaps the most profound feeling of confusion that I have ever had. Seeing Esta sitting there like that, Esta, who at the time could sing every lyric to the Spice Girls song Wannabe, having her sitting there and having her and her grandmother explain to us that they had had to cut Esta's head with a bush knife in order to release the pressure caused by an act of sorcery. Well, the only way I can describe it, the only way I can describe the way that I felt was cognitive dissonance. The way that I made sense of those events, of the discomfort I experienced when trying to hold these two conflicting cognitions at the same time, Esta, who knows how to sing the Spice Girls, and Esta, who had just had her grandmother basically cut her head all the way around with a bush knife, which is this long to release spirits and pressure from sorcery, was actually by remembering Kuru sorcery. So in Kuru sorcery, Shirley shows us that indigenous beliefs and practices are, quote, appropriate to a particular way of life and period of time, end quote, and that by understanding them as such, beliefs and practices must be seen as complex philosophical systems that depend on specific context, and that the work of the anthropologist is to meticulously document the world they're living in at any given time. The answers to complex questions lie in that ethnographic documentation of context. And here's the context in which Shirley was working when she did the research for Kuru Sorcery. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes from the book, too, except mine are all devastating. So here goes. Quote, since record-keeping began in 1957, 3 years after the Australian administration established a patrol post at Akapa, some 2,500 people in the region have died from Kuru. Approximately 80% of those deaths have occurred among Foray-speaking peoples. In the early years of investigation, over 200 patients died annually, which at the time approached 1% per annum of the affected populations. The average life expectancy for South Foray women born in the mid-1960s was estimated at a little over 20 years. Between 1957 and 1968, Over 1,100 kuvu deaths occurred in the South Foray population of only 8,000 people. When the incidence of kuvu reached its peak in the late 1960s, the South Foray believed that their society was coming to an end. And that's end of the quotes. And indeed, since the majority of the victims of the disease were women of childbearing age, in many ways their society was coming to an end. When a woman died, her husband and other men connected to her were excluded from exchanges and redistributions of wealth that were key to their status and the key to gluing Foray society together. This gave rise to instability and political animosity, and that gave rise to suspicion about sorcery. Shirley teaches her readers about sorcery in the context of Foray philosophy and Foray social relations, and her analysis of this society in crisis and decline raises questions about power, domination, gender relations, marginality, alterity, and globalization. And I'll return to that in just a second. I can't imagine what it must have been like to do the field work that Shirley did when she did it. Kuvu sorcery tells us of a world that is falling apart. Most of you have probably seen the extraordinarily upsetting images in the film First Contact. Those of people in the highlands of New Guinea seeing outsiders with white skin for the first time, seeing the immediate death that a rifle can bring for the first time, and hearing European music for the first time. Perhaps fewer of you have read the body of literature on first contact in New Guinea. But across the island, in culturally specific ways, people saw the coming of Europeans as a whole being ripped in the world. Some believed that the white skins of Europeans marked them as ancestors who were pouring back into the world of the living from the world of the dead. Others in the eastern highlands, like the Gimi with whom I work, saw Europeans for the first time during now what we now think of as epidemics. In the eastern highlands where I work, there was probably a cholera or either typhoid epidemic at about the same time that the first patrol officers worked through Gimi territory. And so Gimi were experiencing diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, severe dehydration, fatigue, fever. Some people had delirium. So the world was in upheaval across the eastern highlands, and this happened in lots of places. Add to that for the Foray, kuvu, a disease that is too awful to describe. To imagine the kind of dedication that it must have taken to Foray peoples, to her research questions, and to her unyielding curiosity about the world, for Shirley to conduct research, the extensive research that she did in that place at that time, is just astounding to me. So this is an extraordinary book written by an extraordinary person. So to return to what Shirley theorizes in the book, in kuvu sorcery, Shirley theorizes power, domination, globalization, gender, marginality, alterity, social change, networks, hybridity, and loss. And she does this based on her empirical evidence. She takes Foray being in the world so seriously as a coherent system of philosophical understanding and explanation that she does it the honor of allowing it to produce new theoretical understandings of our shared world. Wouldn't it be nice if all anthropology today would just take a breath, step back, and perhaps follow Shirley's lead? So I started this talk with my memory of how kuvu sorcery helped me understand how I might begin to understand the Gimi world. And I want to end by saying that in addition to the gift of insight that Shirley has given me, over the past decade, Shirley has given me the gift of mentorship and friendship. She has helped me navigate our wonderful, complicated profession, and I suspect that she has helped me in top-secret ways that are only known by my senior colleagues at Columbia and our promotion and tenure committee. So, thank you for that and everything else.
So many woman hours involved in reading the book and preparing. Thank you both. Thanks to both of you for those wonderful comments, and also to Murphy and Jeff for doing all the background organizing, and to Brian and Janice for getting the heroic efforts in getting the medicine website back up in running again, and also to our great hosts at Wenegrin. So, and I'm glad also that Bob Glass's name was mentioned many times, that, you know, he and I did all the early field work together in the 1960s and the work on cannibalism, so he should be acknowledged at all times too. Well, so I thought about what to write tonight, and I had no idea what they were going to say, but they're friends, and I didn't think it'd be, I'd get trashed. but I thought that, I'd try to write something different, you know, and I began to reflect on the process of choosing what to write about, and what I had chosen to write about in the new edition, and how I had presented it, and since I had a mountain of data from six return trips after 1979, it's long-term field work, so it was unavoidable that I'd take a historical perspective. But the chapters, the new chapters, are quite different. Chapters 12 and 13 are the basic new chapters. There's new introduction, new epilogue too, but they're different not just in the sense that the topics are not the same. Chapter 12 is devoted to Melanesian ethnography and chapter 13 to biomedicine and medical anthropology. But in some ways, there was two very different kinds of exercise. Chapter 12 documents the changing political and economic environment following independence in 1975 and focuses on the big ceremonial exchanges of wealth at marriage and death. To tell this story, the chapter refers to people you would recognize, most of you would recognize most of the people, whose work I cite. Ronald and Catherine Burnt, Paula Brown, Kenneth Reed, Mervyn Meggett, Robert Glass, Gillian Glilson, Marilyn Strathern, Gilbert Hurt, Maurice Cordelier, Dan Jorgensen, and Paige West, among others. Chapter 12 took a journey through the history of anthropological theory and practice in Melanesia from the 1950s to the present, and was written with these anthropologists in mind. The chapter is, in fact, constructed on the bridge work of anthropological forebears, a conversation with colleagues and friends. Chapter 13 is the medical chapter. With the last case of Kuru in 2009, the full story of the epidemic could now be told. The chapter 13 tells the story from the point of view of medical investigators, the foray, and the ethnographer, and cites relevant publications in the fields of biomedicine and medical anthropology. But I excluded from this chapter the story of Kuru told by a dizzying cast of characters, popular science writers, journalists, comedians, poets, novelists, filmmakers, and a well-known American musician, among others. This background activity, hidden behind the veneer of scholarly constraint, provides the story of Kuru that is often fantastic and filled with error. I take this opportunity to let you know what I left out. Fabrications began early on. The government physician who had shown Carlton Geijerschik the first case of Kuru in 1957 and was soon assigned to the Kuru Research Project wrote an autobiography in 1978, presenting what he said was his intimate knowledge of foray culture. Five pages were devoted to descriptions of foray therapies, different forms of sorcery, the changes in gender relations resulting from the death of so many women, all taken from an article I had published in the Papua New Guinea Medical Journal some years earlier. Five pages, straight. The author said that his ability to provide such detailed information resulted from his intensive field studies on the social effects of Kuru, which was the title of the article. I had thought this scarcely disguised piracy had a kind of charming indifference to the scholarly etiquette by someone who had a reputation for somewhat erratic behavior. Dealing with the broad spectrum of popular writing is another matter, especially since this is probably the source for most people's information about Kuru and the foray. The seduction to write about Kuru, of course, has to do with two Nobel Awards, the jailing of one's recipient charged with pederasty, the exotic location with its images of primitivism, and no doubt the topic of cannibalism. All this offers the thrill of writing about transgressive behavior on a number of topics. Only incest appears to be missing. Popular science writers, often loose with the facts, let imagination displace careful reading of the scientific literature. It was said, among other things, that the disease attacked victims at younger and younger ages, a misreading of the epidemiology. The reverse is the case. That prior to burying the body, women sucked the brain from the dead person's skull, licking the straw as they worked and sharing it with their children. The foray did not eat uncooked brains, and the image of people using straws in the New Guinea Highlands in the 1950s is mind-boggling. It was also said that initial symptoms of Kuru and other dementias included self-neglect and failure to groom, bathe, or eat properly is a misconception that appears to be based on data concerning animals, not humans. there are prion diseases in animals. And when Gardashek died in 2009, the newspapers of the world said incorrectly that he had discovered the link between Kuru and cannibalism, and sometimes also the identification of the prion, the infectious agent, which was Prusiner's discovery and for which he received the other Nobel Prize. Popular science writers also offered a number of alternative theories of disease causation. A French physician sent me some material in which he proposed that no infectious agent was responsible for Kuru, the prion disease in cattle, or the disease in humans, which were stress-caused diseases in both humans and animals. And during 2002, I received a series of inventive emails from someone with a reputation for proposing alternative explanations and who disarmingly called himself Mad Cow Purdy, asking for ethnographic information that might support his view that Kuru resulted from ingesting toxic materials. Could the Fori have made a tea brewed from pine needles? There's a little pine forest in the Eastern Highlands, which only he seems to have known about. He asked, or perhaps they had used cooking containers made from the sheet metal salvaged from the Japanese plane that had crashed in the Eastern Highlands in 1943 during the Second World War. The first reported cases of Kuru occurred half a century earlier. The popular press in Australia set a low tone at the outset, referring to Kuru as the laughing death, a sensational and insensitive reading of the early symptoms of emotional lability. A 1973 Newsweek story told its readers that Fori women still fall prey to Kuru, a disease that literally makes them laugh themselves to death. And the jailing of Carlton Gardashek in 1997 resulted in a wave of yellow journalism, a term that originated during the 19th century to describe the scandal-mongering battles between Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst, a form perfected, if that's the right word, by the awful Australian news baron Rupert Murdoch. The crisis in Britain over mad cow disease in the 1990s ignited an explosion of apocalyptic prose. Journalists wrote about the dangers of a terrifying new plague and the shocking legacy of a 20th century disease. Mad cow disease was said to be a global populist issue and an icon of our time. Television accounts of mad cow disease became a form of theatre. In 2000, in a ritual echo of the British agricultural minister's television performance in which he persuaded his daughter to eat a beef burger, the French farm minister declared on television, "I eat beef, my children eat beef, and all the scientists who are mad cow disease experts eat beef, and so do their children." The connection of Kuru, so-called mad cow disease, an inappropriate dubbing, not unlike the term laughing death, led many creative writers to turn to humour. A small sample, this is just a small sample, includes a short story, said by its author to be a comedy based very, very loosely on what was a true story. A French filmmaker explored mad cow disease from the perspective of Hindus who hold a different image of the cow. A witty essay about mad cow disease from the point of view of the cow. A poem entitled Mad Cows and Englishmen. And a chamber music ensemble by the American composer John Adams, which included a segment called Hoedown Mad Cow, said to be a version of the traditional hoedown that addresses the fault lines of international commerce from a distinct American perspective, a whimsical reference, presumably, to the dangers of industrial farming, the feeding of cattle to cattle, and the collusion of the various ministries of agriculture. French cattle raisers had a sane cow barbecue in the Luxembourg Gardens in an attempt to persuade the public that the dangers lay in meat from dairy herds, not beef cattle, and mad cow jokes by the thousands can be found on a number of websites. A sense of postmodern pastiche and irony was compounded by popular reference to mad cows, mad scientists, mad bureaucrats, and rogue and ghost proteins. The Kuru story seems to have found its place also in films, DVDs, video games, and novels where fantasy roams free. I provide short abstracts from three novels to give you a sense of the flavor. Stephen Cannell's novel, The Devil's Workshop, written in 1999, begins with Stacy, a USC graduate student investigating the suspicious death of her microbiologist husband, Max, said to have been a suicide. Max worked at the Army Medical Facility at Fort Dedrick, evaluating killer proteins called prions. Under the supervision of Dexter DeMille, who is said to have worked with Carlton Gardashek in New Guinea, So he knew all about Kuru and prions. You'll recall that Stanley Prusner, not Gardashik, identified prions. Actually, Gardashik refused to use the word prions and stuck to using Slovaris until the end of his life. And, of course, they're not. They're two distinctly different things. Max had apparently discovered that DeMille was developing what would be called the first prion bioweapon, so he had to be murdered, referred to here as collateral damage. DeMille had made his killer protein more potent by mixing strains of Kuru and mad cow disease, but the problem was that the destruction of the brain took over 2 years, too long for a bioweapon, and perhaps also for the plot. So he mixed it with a strain of Epstein-Barr virus, a virus in the herpes family, which proved to be a perfect accelerant. Well, you can see where this is headed. Stacy and her team, following a hair-raising confrontation with many near-death experiences, prevent the use of this rogue protein in biological warfare and save humankind. Michael Crichton's State of Fear in 2004 gives Gaidashik and Kuru a small walk-on part in a story about eco-terrorists misusing research funds to create a global catastrophe that will cause global warming and mass flooding. The investigating team that we know will prevail travel great distances to locate the terrorists, reaching an island in the Solomons, where they battle with crocodiles. One man sent ahead is said to have been eaten by cannibals. This turns out to be a fake death to throw the eco-terrorists off the trail. But it provides an opportunity for a conversation about cannibalism between two scientists. One raises the topic of cannibalism. The other says cannibalism was a myth. Crichton footnotes here Bill Aaron's 1979 publication, The Man-Eating Myth, Anthropology and Anthropophagy, in which Aaron's dismissed cannibalism as an accepted social practice. The first man says he is wrong. In New Guinea, they had a disease called Kuru, transmitted by eating the brains of their enemies. Actually, the 48 deceased relatives, not enemies. The listener replies, that's not true. The first man says, Jadek Gaidashek won the Nobel Prize for it. Also not true. The second man, but that was a long time ago. The first man, 60s, 70s, the 48 had, in fact, stopped eating people by the eating their relatives by the early 1960s. Second man, you guys just like to tell scary stories at the expense of indigenous people of the world. This is a sentence we can agree with. And this year, 2013, Hanya Yanagihara has just published a novel called The People in Trees. She says that the inspiration for her story about a protagonist called Norton Perina came not from Galton Gaidashek's contribution to medical science, but from fascination with his notorious personal life, that he had adopted 50 children from Melanesia and Micronesia, brought them to live with him in the United States, and was sent to prison for sexual abuse. Yanagihara may have begun with a not-too-delicate intrusion into a personal life, but she adds her own elements of fantasy, horror, Indiana Jones-like adventures, and rumors of lost tribes who inhabit a fictional tiny Micronesian island. The protagonist, Norton Perina, who has a great hunger for scientific recognition, publishes his findings about the lost tribe and their amazing longevity. Some are said to be more than 150 years old. But while their bodies have stayed young, their minds have deteriorated. Perina kills a sacred turtle. Legend has it that the longevity of the tribe is linked to eating the meat of this rare island turtle, and takes it back to America, hoping he can separate the meat's benefits of longevity from the side effects of dementia. His publications bring him advancement, but set in motion the destruction of the island as scientists and strip the land of vegetation and wildlife. Forest trails are replaced by airstrips, and island culture is diluted by modern influences, their ancestral ways and rituals decimated. Collateral damage here is said to be ecological and cultural. Readers are offered the opportunity to contemplate whether we can justify, in the name of science, the suffering and death of lab animals. What to say about all of this? First, the impetus for some medical investigators to tell the Kuru story, overlooking the published work of others, both medical and anthropological, continues to this day. This can be corrected to some degree by providing evidence of relevant publications, which is why Chapter 13 may appear to be a bit dogged in its attention to documenting the history of Kuru research. And as anthropologists, we understand that epidemics release marginal ideas and unmask opposed interest kept subdued in less critical times. Kura may not be unique in giving rise to alternative theories of disease causation and various forms of what is considered sometimes to be called pseudoscience. The physicist Robert Ehrlich's recent book, 9 Crazy Ideas in Science, A Few Might Even Be True, advises us to keep an open mind. The history of science is littered with crazy ideas, but some, he says, like the concept of gravity and evolution, have surfaced from a pool of crazy ideas. It might be said that another crazy idea was Prusna's concept of a prion, a protein, not a bacteria or a virus, that was an infectious agent in Kuru. This seems to be lost in the popular telling of the Kuru story. And there is an honored place for journalists writing about scientific topics. The loss of many local newspapers in the United States, however, has added to the diminishment of investigative journalism, and advertising now plays a larger role in newspaper contact. To some degree, journalism is under siege. A flurry of concern over the handling of mad cow disease in the popular press led a contributor to the journal Nature to observe that the need to inform the public about potential health hazards, as well as the media need for sensational headlines, had threatened to compromise the scientific process. And I think the adoption of the Kuru story and cannibalism in novels and films has a place for the creative use of the imagination, often used to convey a social message, even when the story seems out of control. This is an old literary device. Like Crichton's lesson on global warming and Yanagihara's message about the environment, Flaubert's 1862 novel, Salambo, a story about cannibalism set in Carthage in the 4th century, was designed to flout the conventions of the literary world and vilify the bourgeoisie. The problem with contemporary fantastic literary renditions of the Kuru story, however, is that the fore are often identified and treated as less than human. I didn't mention a popular earlier sci-fi novel called Dream Park by Larry Nivens and Stephen Barnes, published in 1981 and set in New Guinea. In the afterword, the authors say that the Fori do indeed exist, that they have Kuru and are feared as cannibals of terrific ferocity. This is not true. They eat their relatives during mortuary rituals. Anyway, but worse, the novel describes the American game players encountering their enemies who turn out to be the Fore. Fore warriors and Fore zombies, the undead, are described as having oversized heads, claw-like hands, and scarred, greased bodies. The women zombies and children are said to be the worst. Quote, they laughed endlessly, their bodies twitching with spasms, the laughter blending with hungry growls. Many of the women were bare-breasted, but the effect wasn't erotic. Alex knew that it would be a long time before he could look at a half-naked woman without remembering the empty-eyed zombies of New Guinea. In this one passage, the author have distorted the features of the Kuru epidemic, presented an image of Papua New Guinea as a land of savages, and revealed their own macho sensibilities. The inaccurate literary and media accounts of the people we work with has become a hot topic in the past few weeks among anthropologists working in Melanesia, although the discussion on the association's listserv, which I know Paige also reads, had begun earlier over Jared Diamond's misrepresentation of New Guinea warfare and his neo-Darwinian view of human development with its quick passage from the Stone Age to modernity in his book The World Until Yesterday. A special session has been proposed for the association's next annual meeting with the title, Tell Me What You Do, Communicating Science to the Public. I have told this story of inaccuracies, alternative theories, sensationalism, and stereotypes because it seems that there is some recognition now that anthropologists should talk about their work to a wider audience. The call for a greater public engagement is, in fact, the theme of this year's annual anthropology meeting in Chicago. Perhaps you would like to discuss some of these issues or even ask questions about Kuru.